All right. Hello, critics and theorists. Welcome to episode 5 of Critique of the Podcast Forum. I'm Mac, member of the Critical Theory Working Group, and I'm here talking to Anna Tara, my fellow member, about Richard Levin's and Richard Lewontin's book, The Dialectical Biologist. And we're going to kind of talk through their book, their larger kind of oeuvre a little bit, and use that as a springboard to talk a little bit about the organism and its place in philosophy, the philosophy of life, the concept of life, and all of the different crazy speculative theories that we have on those things. Anatar, do you want to get us started by talking a little bit about, or do you want to introduce yourself and maybe give us a little background on like how you got into this sort of thing?
Thanks, Mac. So I am Anatara. I am an engineer by training and occupation, more or less. I've read The Dialectical Biologist maybe in like undergraduate when I was doing research work in synthetic biology, which, despite its name, I think is just a rebrand of genetic engineering, because that's what it amounts to. And it kind of gave, it was like a gestalt shift where I was like, oh, because the work that you do in synthetic biology amounts to like changing the genome of different microbes and then killing them with antibiotics. And who survives is you know who has the genome that you purposely inserted to resist the antibiotic. And then as I was doing this, I was like, am I doing primitive accumulation? I'm just doing primitive
Yeah, as
accumulation.
everyone would ask themselves in
Am
that
I doing?
situation,
And
yeah.
I went on this whole philosophy of biology binge because I think this thought was inoculated by Richard Levins and Richard Lewontin, essentially. So I've became the resident science and tech biology guy in the CTWG. And the more that you ask these questions, the more you realize that they've been more or less on the same beat, asking similar questions.
Yeah, for sure. That's really, yeah, that's good. Like, I think that that's like a good opportunity to kind of get a little into maybe some of the background of the book itself and like this kind of strain in Marxism that is really looking at science. Could you talk a little bit about that?
That's a good question. So The Dialectical Biologist was released in 1985. Richard Lewontin and Richard Levins are like this a part of the greater New Left. They were editors at the Monthly Review. They were key members of Science for the People. And and they were instrumental in the science wars, both in the 80s and early 2000s. And I think with The Dialectical Biologist, I think what this book means, at least now that we're maybe 40 years, more than 40 years away from it, is that it's, I would say, the
Wait,
second.
actually, one sec. Could I stop you for a sec? Could you explain what the science wars were in the 80s and the early 2000s?
So science. Both the 80s, so the 2000s are different than the 80s. The 80s were like you had a bunch of science related controversies. So at the time you had the forgot what the book was, but a book that was really instrumental in the environmentalist movement. And so people were like really up in arms on pesticides, which the Dialectical Biologist has a
Was it
chapter on.
Silent Spring, maybe?
The Silent Spring, exactly.
Yeah.
People were scared of the weapons being deployed in the Vietnam War, where they were like, oh, all of these technology institutes are just essentially these larger pipelines of the military-industrial complex, or the subterranean, which then became more mainstream in the 2000s, creationist stuff, on like people who are against evolution.
Mm-hmm.
So a bunch of these different themes on, I guess, the quote-unquote subjective aspects of science, because they want to undermine its objectivity, because it was being this new authority. At least that's how people took it to be in the 80s and 2000s. In our case, we're in a completely different era. But that's kind of some of the themes of those quote-unquote science wars, mainly in the U.S. and the U.K., I would say.
Okay. Yeah, thanks. That's helpful. Do you want to get back into this kind of story about, like, the background of the dialectical biologist?
Yeah, the dialectical biologist is, like, I would say it's continuing the division of labor of the common project of Marx and Engels, where their common project name of scientific socialism, right? So Marx took the critique of political economy. So he took that part. And then Engels took the anthropology, science, and even the actual political work of it. After Marx's death. And so a bunch of Marxist scientists critically inherited this kind of role from Julius Shaxel to Christopher Caldwell, a bunch of the British scientists, a bunch of Russian scientists. And then I would say the one that kind of puts these various contributions and kind of solidifies them, it would be this book, I think, where the various themes tackled by all these thinkers is kind of tackled here, where you have to take, I think, ideology theory and ideology critique all the way to science, where even science isn't safe from not being critiqued. This is for the validity of our theory in practice, to kind of,
I think it's interesting. We were talking a little bit about this earlier, but it's interesting that when you read these kind of like science minded Marxists who are really engaging seriously with science itself, like not just in the dialectical biologist, but also with the, school of like historical epistemology and Peter Damrow, who we both have also read, that like Engels really seems to be such a central figure compared even to Marx, you know? And like, it does feel like that kind of, there's an Engelsian kind of trend in Marxist science that you don't necessarily see as much in like, you know, Marxism as such or something like that.
Honestly, I think I would say it's because a lot of the Engels' work were also collaborative with Marx. Marx did give feedback to some of them. And a lot of these Marxist scientists were really careful readers of both Marx and Engels. Hassan was read a bunch of Marx's manuscripts and work, during essentially the Russian Civil War, and he was right. He then went on like a scientific mission to give his Newton presentation, similar to, I would say, even Lewontin and Levins. Lewontin essentially loves the Grundrisse, like his whole theory of a niche construction, which is one of the main ideas without being named as such in this book, The Dialectical Biologist. The organism is both subject and object of evolution, and they make their evolutionary pathways, essentially. all
yeah,
these.
Could you just go into that a little more? Like, because I think that niche construction is one of these like crucial ideas that kind of comes out of this book. And I think it's something that's totally worth kind of like getting into, which can maybe help us like get into the book a little bit.
Yeah. They developed this mainly at the first part of the book. So the first three chapters, where the third chapter is where they use the term or the whole phrase organism as both subject and object. So niche construction is now like an autonomous theory. It was inspired by Lewontin Levins, but now it's kind of taken up by different scientists. What it mainly says is that the organism, being what it is, morphologically, behaviorally, physiologically, modifies its own selection pressures. And in doing so, mm-hmm. changes its evolutionary pathways. And this goes to every organism. The amount of capabilities that you have obviously depends on the organism itself, what it does. And once you have this, I think you can essentially reply to what Lukács says in History and Class Consciousness, where he goes like, nature is just a social category. And that is correct. But if that is true, the reverse of that statement is equally true, that society is a natural category, you know? And so then the question then immediately becomes the question of alienation, which I think this book is what wants you to feel. And I think what they wanted to do in this way is to bring forth or really emphasize the agency of the organism, this not just human beings. So they use beavers, they have plants where they use, mm-hmm. they even use the metaphor of plants farming fungi.
Yeah, and I...
Using their...
Yeah, people. And I think this is really interesting, and it's kind of like maybe even worth getting a little more into like their specific... Like, because they talk about like different ways that the organism creates its own environment in the book. And like the way that, like, you know, I remember like one of them is just that like the organism, just based on like things like its size, like how it interacts with the environment, like it, there are only certain aspects of the environment that actually matter to the organism. And along with that, the organism can move, it can shift its environment. But then there's also, I think, this kind of like more intensive version of this, that where, you know, the organism is like actively kind of shaping its environment in terms of like it's eating certain things. It's like a beaver is building dams that completely like restructure the ecosystem that it like that it lives in.
So this is excellent. So this is, I think, what they want us to think about. They want to change, they want to do two things. They want to change the theory by proposing a new metaphor. And so they have issues with the metaphor of adaptation, and they have an issue with the metaphor of development. And so to them, adaptation is like this almost autonomous external force, just happens to the organism, goes to the population, selects what it selects, and boom. We got the new parts, you know. We got the new traits, and then for the developmental development. It assumes that the core was there from the very beginning. You know, it's like the moment the sperm and the egg make the zygote, the man was there. You know,
I was actually talking about this in my like science of logic group the other night, because we got to this point in Hegel in like the concept of life, where like he's talking about how like the germ contains the like genus like already in it, and like there it has this kind of sense of unfolding. But I think it's a little more complicated in Hegel than that, but that's the kind of like Lamarckian kind of like older biological developmental conception that they're kind of like fighting against, right? It's just this idea of like an unfolding out from a predetermined kind of like germ cell or something like that.
So those are his targets. They really, really wanted to keep the complexity. And they didn't want to keep the complexity just for theoretical reasons, right? All of these are like intensive political things for them to think through, right? It's not just like this is just the correct science, but the correct science has to be also done for political work. So they begin their this book with saying science is a social process, is a social product, and then you have to be honest about your commitments. And so I think, and so they propose this new metaphor of construction, right? Because there's no environment out there; it's created by the organism, and they are dialectically, reciprocally determined. But to answer your question, where you're like, oh, the size of the organism, right? A microbe would feel the natural force of diffusion, and it matters to its life. Much more than a more macro metazoa like us, where we feel gravity much more, but we really don't care about diffusion, you know, where the microbe.
What is diffusion? Could you just go into that a bit? Because I don't actually know what that is.
So diffusion in physics is basically a natural phenomena. It happens across mixtures, a perfume. So if you have a perfume bottle and you just press it, you have this fluid diffusing in the air that can be completely modeled by diffusion equations. I completely forgot his name. I just call them the diffusion equations. And I think if you put diffusion equations, you'll find
guy,
them.
You know?
Yeah. you get them. And so this is what people usually mean by diffusion. Turns out that dynamic just exists everywhere. So when you put milk in tea, that's a diffusion. That has the same dynamic as a perfume when you press it, goes to the air. That has the same dynamic as mixing, stuff like this. And diffusion is just very slow.
For microbes, like just in particular, how are they affected by that?
When they're small, when it's small, that force really does affect you because they live in aqueous environments usually, or biofilms or whatever. So that small contribution appears to them as a stronger force. If we were to be microbes, we would know that this physical force will be there. I'm not sure how to answer the question in a different way.
I think that's helpful.
But interestingly enough, that point they inherit from a previous quote unquote dialectical biologist the scientist G.B.S. Haldane, where he makes the point of saying, hey, organisms are not machines because size is actually a determinate feature of the organism, which completely changes everything else about it, which is not true for a machine. And these things, at least in the philosophy of science, mechanism and organism kind of follows this classical thing that we inherit from Aristotle, which is like, what is the function of a teleological explanation? And the biologists, given their object, did not want to be teleological after Darwin, given the 19th and 20th centuries. This debate continues to the 21st. But thankfully people are now aware of what teleology means in its correct form, and not just like a linear.
What is that correct form?
It's just a form of explanation. You know that the living thing has agency, and to pursue its means, it pursues like an end. And it's that simple.
Well, and this is related to like self-organization, right? Like, isn't that like kind of like part of this? I don't know. I think that I not being super scientifically literate, I approach it through Hegelian lens again, where it's like the all organisms kind of have a telos of like self-reproduction, right? Of like recreating themselves and like, you know, like kind of like furthering, you know, like everything that they do kind of destroys themselves in a way. Like they use their own self as a means, their own body as a means, but like all of those activities are directed at like recreating that same body to like reuse as a means. And that's the kind of like Hegelian teleology of life. Is this kind of like resurgent scientific conception similar to that? Or do you think that there are like important differences?
Let me think. So the conception is similar, but it's being debated at different dimensions. It's being debated on far from equilibrium thermodynamics. How does the organism dissipate the various energies and heat? How is it open to the environment? How is it? The word that is in vogue now is relevance realization, which is like, how does it quote unquote know what is relevant in the environment? Because there's so much in there, you know, there's so much stuff. It's like, this is salient.
In the dialectical biologist, one of the things that they talk about in that subject object of evolution chapter is the way that like some like plants will like store up in some way a count of the number of days above a certain temperature, and once it hits a critical threshold, they'll then like start to open up their buds. And it feels like that's part of this like relevance realization thing, right?
Yeah. So all of this is talked about in like a bunch of literature. It's like a very active research area. The physics of life and even honestly, we're just essentially being back to Neo-Aristotelians again. Where we're like plants, animals, human beings, where the human being is just not just like the rational animal, but just an animal that evolved. So it can kind of continue this. And I think the perspective that they're advocating for is able to take into account how such a differentiation can happen, if that makes sense, between all these different species. And the answer is just, that's how they did it, and that's how they survived, you know? And there's a bunch of contingency in there, there's a bunch of complexity, but this is how the organic forms that we receive got there. It's less rosy than the Hegelian picture, but that's the picture, and that's the picture I think their collaborator Stephen Jay Gould really pursued, because he was the paleontologist of the group, and kind of like Marx, they were doing the science but also were the first to kind of write the history of it. So Stephen Jay Gould has like a tome on the evolutionary theory. Same with Lewontin. So Lewontin himself is like trained by a Russian biologist and Dobieski, who is a legend in his own right. And so like all of this unique science history is also kind of because of the Marxist scientist, you know, the science history before then was just kind of mythology, you know, of mythology to justify colonialism mythology, to say that Britain is the best, or America is the best, or Germany is the best, or whatever thing that you needed science to do.
And I think you can kind of see that in like all of their work. Is like they do a lot. They usually, like, especially the first three chapters of The Dialectical Biologist, but kind of all over the place, they do a lot of like historical situation in a way that's trying to dispel these kind of like myths and these kind of like faulty self-conceptions of science, of like the scientist and like scientific history, as like a part of the kind of like imminent critique of like biology or something, or whatever like specific concept they're talking about, whether it's like Darwinian evolution or adaptation, which I think they're kind of talking about the same thing there, or, you know, or whether it's this kind of genetic paradigm, like that, like the kind of thing of like the genes determine everything, you know, like it's all just genes.
I think the reason why I keep coming to them is that they kind of just put all the questions out there. So one of my favorite chapters, it's not perfect by any means, of this book, is when, and I'm pretty sure it's written by Richard Levins, is like, it's called, let me find it in the book here. Think it's chapter 12, and it's called The Research Needs for Lion Community Health, where you just see Levins bring all of these different themes that we've been talking about: the inseparability of the organism and the environment, the organism as subject and object. Another theme we haven't talked about is the interpenetration of the gene, organism, and environment as like one big unity. He kind of takes all this global picture, what they call dialectical materialism, their framework, and they kind of just apply it to the Latin community in the United States. And you kind of get a picture that you rarely get, right? It's just like the physiology of the Latin American community, the language, the names, the areas, the densities of where they live, what else, their lived environment, and how do we even model this, and how does even modeling it either reinforces their oppressive conditions and or misses it entirely. Or how they're like, oh, if we follow the typical way an epidemiologist, or like a typical, I don't know, health bio, somebody who works in like in the medical industry, you would have like the dichotomy of like a lifestyle and then the environment, where the lifestyle is just consumer choices, you know, where they're like, oh, they smoked. And it's like, why did they smoke? You know, it's like because they're stressed and working all of these jobs, you know, and stuff like this. And I think on like an abstract level, this kind of move of keeping a local community's needs while having this global view and kind of knowing how to go between these levels is what I find appreciative of this whole book. Because they have the same move when they talk about how does a first world scientist help third world science. They're like, yeah, so the first world science has all the resources. They don't know how good they have it. The third world has to do science. But at the same time, it only has one model of science, developmentalism. You know, which has all these errors that we just talked about this whole book. There has to be solidarity, participation between the scientists, where the first world scientist knows how to listen to the needs of the third world. And at the same time, give the critiques of the way that their science developed, because it was not neutral. This remains a question to us. You know, we felt this very, very vividly during the COVID pandemic, when the vaccines were not distributed equitably due to like intellectual property, right? And we'll probably feel it even
more.
Which
is really like intellectual property is like the bane of like access to healthcare, like across the world, right? Like it's like U.S. enforcement of like these insane intellectual property laws.
It's also, in my opinion, the main thing that's keeping biotech afloat, right? It's like, how do I how do I privatize genes? Well, I kind of in a similar thing of this in this book, where they're like, okay, you can't change the cycle of the organism, but you can change the you can control the input. And you can control the output, and that's how they control farming. You know, I can't change how you need health, but I can control the input. And boom, you know. I got the regularity.
And I feel like that. I feel like that brings out like the way that this kind of reductionist model that they're constantly critiquing is like a part of kind of like, is like a social product in a way, because it's like, oh, like in order to commodify these things, like we actually just need to deal with it as like an input output machine, right? And we can't actually like deal with it in this kind of like multi-leveled complexity that they're kind of talking about here. And I think that that's something that I really appreciated about the book, is the way that it feels like it brings together this kind of like sociological almost kind of like level of critique with the kind of like very specific, detailed, like scientific critique, and kind of like shows the way that you can use the same kind of like analytical tools across both of them.
Yeah, I think this is something where I want critical theory to be able to do, because and this is critical theory started in its genesis, trying to give an account of the scientific crisis. And now we're in a moment where we have just like a truly global natural crisis in climate change and the Anthropocene, and a bunch of other interrelated crises of education and de-skilling, the various coming pandemics that we know are going to happen because of how we treat other species, primarily because it's zoological. Health, the U.S. still has this predatory insurance system. And I think what they do is that they're able to make these various moments pop out, right? So it's like, this is this is the history, this is the philosophy, here's the econ, here's the sociology, here's this how this comes out in science. If you try to take this out, you actually miss important dynamics of what we're trying to capture, whatever phenomena. And in their case, it's all biological, given their expertise. But I would wager that if you bring like an electronic engineer, we can probably make a similar critique. You know, how is the connectivity of the internet, the data centers and how, the resources that they need. This conversation is now live again with AI, you know, how does that go to organizing? You know, we all use phones at the same time. We know that a phone is like a means of a surveillance, but it also a way to kind of touch with other members of who we organize with. What does it mean to, or like, what are the options to say, have like, an autonomous, away from the normal internet. There is a way, I forgot what it was called, but stuff like this, like a more, like it has to be both local and global at the same time view that kind of brings this integrative approach. And I think the dialectical biologist and other Marxist scientists were like kind of building the tools for this scientific program. You mentioned historical epistemology. That's like a child of Hessen and Grossman, in particular. So it has links to Marx and Engels, but it's mainly Hessen and
Well,
Grossman.
could you just tell a little about Hessen and Grossman and maybe like a brief kind of overview of the kind of like Hessen Grossman thesis as it's called?
So very quickly, Boris Hessen was a Russian physicist, incredibly brilliant, extremely well-read, very famous for a speech that he gave in the 1930s on Newton, where he kind of showed that a bunch of the abstractions of Newtonian mechanics came from the needs of 17th century London, essentially. And then he kind of gives an account into all of this. Grossman goes further, kind of builds on this thesis by going even more back to kind of showing Descartes and the various new scientists and the emergence of what we would call the quote unquote scientific method. And they are, and yeah, and so they used similar. Hessen is actually cited in the Dialectical Biologist in the Lysenko chapter, so the genealogy is already there in the books. I'm saying it a lot.
You're
And
good.
yeah.
Yeah. Keep, yeah, I mean, yeah. So, yeah, I mean, I think it is interesting that there are all of these kind of branches, and they're like off of this kind of like shared lineage that goes from kind of like Marx and like particularly Engels, and then through like Hessen and Grossman, and it's in the Dialectical Biologist. It's in, yeah, this historical epistemology stuff. Yeah, I mean, I guess my like it feels like sometimes though it's kind of hard for me at least to kind of like bring the two together in a way, because like it feels like the historical epistemology is like it's so focused on kind of like the tools that we use, right? And like whether they're kind of like physical tools or kind of like conceptual tools or like things like that, and the way that those kind of determine certain pathways through things. Whereas the dialectical biologist, like as you've been kind of talking about, is more about like how do we articulate these different levels of analysis or of abstraction and the way that they interrelate with each other. So, you know, like one feels like it almost has like a very like a much more, I don't know, like singular kind of focus in a way, whereas the other is trying to do this more like global local interaction. Like yeah, I guess just like how do you kind of like see the relation between these kind of these projects?
I think they're very similar. So I think with historical epistemology, one of their key theorists is PJ, the child development psychologist. And one of his, he's like one of the first dimensions, I forgot what his terminology is. But like competencies that we have is a sensory motor dimension of like moving our hands, moving our body. And I think once you bring this bodily dimension of movement, because we usually don't think of this as a form of competency, you know? We don't have robot, like our robot baristas are not that good at movement. You know, so movement is formalistically quite difficult, especially like biomechanical, robotic movement. I think the dialectical biology point would be this itself is an act of cognition by the organism. the movement, how we move, the various habits, sensory motor schemes. You know, we all have probably a similar pattern of how we brush our teeth, which was is socialized, but it's also like a sensory motor, you know, movement that we all do, which is like a thing. And I think if you emphasize this, you kind of bring all the normal historical epistemology concerns without using the tools, or the tools themselves would be our acts. So the act would be the cognitive tool, which would be the means to realize further or reflect or whatever. They have a bunch of crazy cultural abstraction things. So I think that's how they would meet. I would say that in general, there's probably a consensus among the various schools of Marxist bio, like Marxist science, I think, where I think their main of emphasis is that if the organism environment interaction is that key, you can look at both poles to know about the other, if that makes sense.
I think that does. And I think it helps me kind of think about the way that there is almost something circular in what they're doing, where like both reinforce each other in a way, because it feels like historical epistemology, especially with its like, its influence from Piaget, is a lot about like, how do these different levels of abstraction get constructed, both kind of like subjectively and socially? And then it's almost like the dialectical biology paradigm is kind of taking it from the other side of like, let's kind of like deconstruct these kind of like socially kind of constructed, socially and subjectively, and just all the, and like even biologically, like constructed kind of like, like levels of abstraction that like are getting kind of like concretized in different tools that are opening up new possibilities and things. But let's deconstruct it and like figure out like how it all goes back to this level of the organism environment interaction and the different levels at which like that's posed at in a way or something like that.
I think
go ahead.
More or less correct. No, I think you're more or less correct. I think this is where I think it's the open problem, and I think it's to essentially, how do we talk about levels of reality in a sense? In this case, it would be a constructed niche, you know, because it's what we do. The environment is what we do. It's a tough question, right? It's, to think dialectically, you have to have this local global view at all times. And we have this enmeshed, you know, crazy technical, legal, all of these systems together. And that's kind of how it is. It's true for our language, which is also being mediated and changed according to these communication technologies. I think it's the question of, I guess, level. And if you want, if I'm going to give like a putative thing, it's like a local, I don't know, local maxima of regularity, local minima of regularity, you know, it's like, oh, that's a level. And we can just say, okay, this exists or something. It's like a pragmatic concern.
Well, actually, I want to kind of like stop you there for a sec, because I think that this level concept, it's obviously so central to the kind of like project here. And it's one of those things that is like really exciting, the way that they're able to kind of like bridge between these different levels and like move up and down and kind of like back and forth, even it feels like, but it's also kind of like bewildering in a way as like you're reading it. It's like, how do they even do that? How do you even figure out what is a level that's different from another level? Like where's the kind of like separation between them? And it feels like sometimes they're kind of it's something like causal independence or something like that, that helps define levels for them. Because like, I don't know, I'm thinking about, there's this chapter in the beginning of their book, Biology Under the Influence, about like randomness or like chance and determinism, where they're talking about how like randomness is like there's one way to understand it that's like, you know, on the kind of like quantum level where there's just this kind of like deeper kind of like non-determinism or something. And then the other way though is that randomness is kind of like the intervention of something that is causally independent of the kind of like causal chain that you're looking at. And it feels like that kind of relates to their concept of level, is this is something that is in some sense at least causally independent, that then intervenes on something else that's kind of like caught up in another kind of like chain of causation. But I don't know, I'm not sure if that's satisfying either, you know? So I guess I'm just wondering what do you think about that and what they really mean by a level?
Yeah, I've been thinking about this for years and I don't have a satisfying answer. I want to tell you a beautiful answer. I'm like, this is a level. Because if I could find an answer, I would just act politically in the world, you know. I would just do something.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I think for them it has to be a causal story, but I also think they have certain relational properties, which I think give them this level concept, and I think one of them, which they're never like open about, is scale. So depending on the scale of a phenomena, you can construe a level. And I think you can maybe add different other properties, like maybe in the mid scale, you can say the composition of a body matters now, and the interaction between the different constituents of the composition matters. But to them, these are like science questions, and also political questions. Mm-hmm.
It feels like that raises a question, though, of like, are these actually levels of reality, or are they just kind of heuristics that we use? Because like, it feels like it's very hard to define. Like there's a problem of like discreteness and continuity if you're talking about something like scale, right? Where it's like, how do you actually define the boundaries of a certain scale? You know.
I think that's totally where I've been mainly thinking through. It's just like, how do I even put the boundary on this? Because in some sense, like doing this is also the answer to reductionism, if that makes sense. Where you're saying you can't actually just go to the part, you know? So it's like how you do this is your answer. Mm-hmm. And it's just tricky. And I think... yeah, I think this is where I think, I don't know, speculative philosophy comes. I just think you just become a philosopher at that point to do science, to think through these boundary issues of the interface, I guess, between these various levels and these various interactions and dynamics.
Yeah. I mean,
it's a non-answer, but I think it's what it is.
No, for sure. But I think like there is something where it's like, it's kind of like, it's almost like dependent on having a reductionist picture in a way, it feels like, right? Like, cause like, if you have a kind of reductionist picture of like some sort of phenomenon, then it's like, you can specify a level that isn't taken into account in the reductionist picture that does actually influence like the level that that picture is kind of constructed around, you know? But so it's almost like you have to like, you have to have a reductionist picture. You have to have, I mean, it feels almost Hegelian in a way. It's like, you know, like you have a first abstraction, you know, first level of abstraction, and then you kind of have to negate that level of abstraction in order to come to like a more complete kind of like picture that of these different levels that would then kind of almost be situated around like would be more levels of analysis maybe than levels of reality in a way, you know?
I think that could work. I think, I'm thinking about things that we, like some artifacts and some technologies that we have embedded in our world, like the various antennas which connect to various wires and has this massive corporations of like internet service providers that give us the internet, which are now connected to like data centers, connected to various other tech companies. You can talk about levels in the network there. And I think speaking of negation there would be, because the moment I think of levels, I think of the various networks that exist now physically, if that makes sense. I think of the any industry you find, and you find like this hierarchical, you know, we even have a term for it in critical theory, rackets, you know, you know, we find a specific form. And I think that's kind of where my thinking has been. I think it's just like, technically, how do you repurpose these things without having all these, you know, oppressive dynamics, which they like more or less embed. It's a tough one in terms of the act, I guess, embodied and not just like at the level of thought of negation. It's just like actually realistically negating it in an action. It's been a tough one. Like, like, do you see like an organization just making their own internet on like a scale? That's crazy. I don't know. You know?
Totally. Yeah, I guess this kind of gets us into, you know, as we're kind of getting close to the end here, some of the more kind of philosophical speculative stuff we wanted to talk about, especially with this talk of levels and also about, like thought and reality. And I think, you know, like one thing that you've kind of, talked to me about that's always really interested in me is kind of like the place of the organism in philosophy, because like you see this in someone like Hegel, like the like life or the organism is kind of has this central place, but it does feel like there's kind of this broader kind of, I don't know, almost like unspoken centrality of the organism to like different philosophies. And yeah, I guess I wondered if you could just talk a little bit about that and about kind of some of... Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, it's a huge question. You can find analogous problems of the organisms even outside of Western philosophy. I would say that any time, at least in ancient philosophy, and even in the pre-Socratics, if you see body, you can just think organism. If you think about the various people who do natural philosophy, who are like emphasizing the bodily constitution of cognition, I think there are people who are thinking about essentially the problem of the organism. And even I would say within the Hellenistic schools, between the Stoics and the Skeptics, with both their common points of agreement and common points of disagreement, which Hegel puts them as like unhappy consciousness in his Phenomenology of Spirit, would be the problem of the body. The Stoics have this extravagant physics of bodies, you know, that goes all the way to the cosmos and all the way down. And the skeptic wants to just suspend the judgment, you know, and just kind of leave this problem for another time. And it's like an inner battle within their own school.
Yeah.
I think the organism is a tough problem because it asks us again and again, what is nature? Which immediately is a social and political problem. And I think as Marxist, it's, I think, on us to kind of bring nature with us, but not in like a reductionist form, not just in the way that science tells us it is. And I think this is what the Marxist scientist wants to do. This is what Lewontin Levin's continuous hammer home, right? Their penultimate chapter is called What is Human Nature? You know? And they go off on Du Beauvoir, and they're like, a being without a being is still a being. You know? It's just like, you can't do the political work. But then they go on, they say it's like, depending on how you answer what is life, for like on in the context of like an unconscious person or in the context of a human nature, all of these are like political questions. And to them, what they want to emphasize is the social organization, I think. And I think the with the organism and the social organization, it brings form, I think, natural history. And I think this is where we should always emphasize. It's just like, this happened. It's a natural historical thing. It's a critical concept for us. To also answer speculatively, I think, in the full way that both everybody who pursued philosophy, I think, does. It gives agency back to us, but also gives agency back to nature, from which we dominate in our science, in ourselves, and everything else. So I think this is the problem, as I see it, which is the tough problem of just like saying the inseparability, I think, of talking about history and nature at the same time, you know, because those dualism stuff, either when we say nature or nurture, et cetera, like this.
And I think there's also, I don't know, this kind of like philosophical question, maybe, that like I keep like thinking about, that's like, you know, like, I don't know, this is a point that I kind of like take from Hegel in a way, I guess, but that, like, you know, like, there's this conceptuality to an organism. There's a way that, like, you know, like, just like society, like, and you can't actually like point at the organism, right? Like, you know, like, you can't actually like, oh, like, this is the part of the organism that is like, that, I don't know, that like makes it an organism or something, you know, like, it really is in the kind of like interaction of all its parts, or like each part like represents the organism to another part when it acts on it, but other parts represent the organism to it when they act on it. So it there's this like holism that you have to think through when you're thinking through both organism and society, that I think is part of why I've become so interested. The organism, I mean, like for Hegel, life, the individual organism is the first form of the idea, which is the unity of concept and reality. And I think that there's something that's like really appealing to that view. But I think that part of why I'm so interested in biology is not just because it's like interesting on its own, which I've certainly found like since you kind of like introduced me to a lot of this stuff, but it's also that it feels like it gives us like theoretical biology, particularly in like these kinds of traditions, like gives us like new tools to think about that kind of self-organization, that kind of like to think about that problem in a way that's like grounded in like, you know, the actual kind of like scientific view of the organism. Because I think it is really important to make sure that when we're talking about this stuff, we are actually grounding it in like the kind of like up-to-date science, like as far as we can tell, you know? Yeah, I mean, I guess it feels like it does get to all of the kind of really, really kind of like hard but important problems in philosophy of like what you were talking about, like nature and history and like the definition of the human, like thought and reality, like all of these different things feel like they're all bound up in the organism and in particular in the kind of activity and like self-activity of the organism, which is something that like organisms have just like on their own that like other types of things don't necessarily have, you know? So I guess maybe we'll try to close it out there. I'll say, I think everyone should read The Dialectical Biologist and, kind of start thinking about these things. Annatara, thanks for having this conversation with me. It was really, really fruitful, really interesting. Thanks everyone for listening. Bye.